in public tomorrow.
Yes, and it's not that you're challenging them. You're not competing with them. You're not a competitor with them. It's not that you say, look, I behave in such a way and you're doing this or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They shouldn't be, you're not going to show them and express to them or make them feel that you're competing with them and you want them to become like yourself maybe or whatever. No. It's a matter of you're not challenging them, so therefore you will not have a conflict with them. You will not quarrel with them. You will not try to bring your point of view home to them and make them accept it without any understanding, without any reasoning, without any logic.
Yeah.
So they need, especially teenagers, need the logic behind things. So you need to talk to them in these terms, that this is something which is good in itself. It's not because I'm saying so, irrespective of the fact whoever says it. And in whatever terms, in whatever tones it is expressed, our children and human beings as a whole should be, as Mawla Ali al-Islam said, look at what the person is saying
Who
is saying it.
All right, that's very
nice. And I should add, even how is he saying it?
Exactly. Professor, we'll discuss more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and Professor Salman Akhavi is helping us with important tips of upbringing, especially when it comes to advising children. And when children feel like parents are all concerned about their own prestige rather than theirs when they are advising them. Professor, you said that Imam Ali al-Islam teaches us we should look at what is being said rather than who is saying it. And
what words of wisdom,
yeah,
can come for people who may not even, for example, be very much learned or educated.
Yeah.
In our sense, in the sense that we think of them to be learned or educated, or those people, people of the older generations, especially who have a great deal of experience in their lives, they've gained a lot of experience. Their words are words of gold. Sometimes, especially today's kids, maybe ourselves also, when we looked upon our grandparents, we would say, look, they're outdated people. What do they know about life? What do they know about the world today?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, their experience spans over
decades. So you're saying words of wisdom can come from anyone?
Yes, we see that.
But what world is teaching us today, or the way world is going, especially the social media world is taking us, it's showing that it's kind of like as if words of wisdom can only come from the educated people, while as you're saying, words of wisdom can come from anyone, be that old person, be that an educated person, be that an uneducated person. What is important, like, don't look at who is saying.
Yes.
Rather, it's important, look at what is being said.
What is being said.
Yeah.
Al-hikmah dhallatul mu'min. This is one of the sayings we have from the Imams or the Holy Prophet, that he says that wisdom is the thing which has been lost by the mu'mins.
Yeah.
It's something which he's looking for, seeking. It's something which he has not found yet, and he's seeking it, and he should be able to find it. Whenever he finds it and wherever he finds it, he should accept it. Therefore, when we talk about the hadith, this famous hadith of the Holy Prophet, when he says, "Utlubul ilm walau bis-seen," if you want to gain knowledge, you should also travel to China for that. Now, China at that time wasn't a place where religion had been revealed, but it was an old society. It was a civilization. They had many sages. They had many people who had a vast deal of experiences. So they had a great deal of knowledge and wisdom.
Yeah.
So a mu'min, a faithful person, a believing person should be able to go out and seek knowledge and wisdom from wherever he or she can find it. So if we are able to inculcate this understanding, this rational, pure understanding in our children, that we need to find the truth and the rationality in the words spoken by anyone. Doesn't matter who the person is, doesn't matter how he's saying it. He may be saying it in a very...
Maybe some tone that is not...
Yes.
That I don't find very good.
It may be a rude way, but the words have to be taken into account.
Exactly.
What do they imply?
To rethink what was being said. Perhaps we will discuss more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
The Prophet ﷺ said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Professor Salman Akavi, and Professor is helping us how we as parents can behave in a way or advise our children in a way that they do not feel offended or they do not feel like we only care about our own prestige, not about them. Well, Professor Imam Ali Alayhi Salam says a very beautiful thing, that if you want to advise someone, advise him separately. Do not advise him in public, or do not advise that person in front of others, because if you're going to do that, that's going to ruin him rather than that's going to make up the things. What's your take on that?
The dignity of a human being, the reputation of a human being is more sacred than even anything else, and even more than the Holy Kaaba. So we need to understand that the reputation of a human being, especially a believer, a faithful person, is so important. Now, sometimes there comes a situation where you need to carry out act upon the command of Allah Almighty, Amr al-Ma'ruf wa Nahy al-Munkar. We have been commanded by Allah Almighty to carry out this Amr al-Ma'ruf wa Nahy al-Munkar, commanding towards good deeds, ordering people towards good deeds, and forbidding them from evil deeds. And this is something which has to be inculcated from the beginning in our children, that they carry out this very important duty. It is more important than even any other liturgical worship, because it is there that this important institution, this important behavior in society, is something, if it is carried out, then all of Islamic teachings will be implemented. And if it is not carried out, all of the Islamic teachings will be, will fall down onto the ground. So I'm commanding, forbidding good deeds and forbidding evil deeds. This is an important thing. Now, there are different situations where sometimes you need to confront a person in public, because the wrong thing which he is doing is something he will not desist from and refrain from till he is shown something or shown concern and discontent in public. He will only stop. But if it can be done in private, and before it is done in public, the first stage would be to talk to him and advise him and command him to refrain from doing the wrong things,
yeah,
and taking care of the right things. That should be the normal practice. But if that is not effective, then one goes to the next stage.
Okay, we'll be talking about further stages in another session. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Iranian culture and food.
Part 1.
Along with language, flag, religion, customs, traditions, and national arts, food and sofra are among the elements that define nations' identities. Food is a delicious part of culture of every nation and is a good measure to determine kindness, generosity, ethics, protection of environment and nature, and the type of its worldview. Iranian dishes have stories rooted in history. Many of today's dishes in the world were first made and cooked in this country. Iranian dishes have original and natural tastes. We use spices as much as necessary in food. Each culinary school has prominent aroma and flavor that is introduced with it. The fragrance of Iranian cuisine is made of saffron, cardamom, and rose water and a golden color. Iranian food has a mild taste. In cooking, we pay attention to the benefits and what is harmful in the ingredients. Everything must be in balance. Kermanshah, pure animal oil, ambarbu, tarimi and hashimi rice, lamb of Mughan, afshar and sangsari, Azerbaijan yogurt, desful citrus, dates of bam and bushehr, Khorasan wheat, and north and south fish each have a special and unique taste. This documentary is a tribute to thousands of years of Iranian cooking. This work is about Iranian food. It is about people we don't know, but who are involved in our sustenance. This documentary is a tribute to the mothers of this land who taught their children the cooking traditions of Iran generation after generation so that this old and unique art remains eternal. This documentary is a tribute to our beloved country, Iran. Iran is a country full of wealth in so many ways, tens of generations before us, and we use the same Iranian dishes, and it is up to us to protect the sacred heritage. I'm Nusha Tabibi Gilani. I am interested in Iranian culture and food. after the invasion of Mahmud Hotak and the destruction of the Safavid dynasty, and a turbulent period was imposed on Iran. The conflicts and rise of Nadir Shah and then the rule of Karim Khan Zand brought short periods of balance and peace that were not very stable. In these periods, naturally, decorative arts and the construction of buildings and emirates were not considered and did not have a chance to grow. Agha Muhammad Khan, the ruler of the Qajar dynasty, established a new era for Iran by unifying the country and establishing regulations, stability, and security. In this period, the construction of buildings, state emirates, and decorative arts started again. Qajari's special aesthetics gradually appeared. There is a mixture of delicate and detailed Safavid art and European-style paintings. The use of new colors and patterns signaled the beginning of another era in Iranian fine arts. Gulistan Palace in Tehran is a perfect example of Qajar art. Its foundation was laid during the Safavid rule and reached perfection and beauty during the time of the Qajar rulers. We can see a collection of carved tiles, statues, marble thrones, perforated windows, delicate sash windows with colorful glasses, and detailed mirror work. There are rooms that are covered from half of the walls to the ceiling with paintings of faces of the mythological and historical kings of Iran, flowers, birds, arabesque and toranj patterns. There are also beautiful nastaliq scripts in this place. The Qajari seems a little rougher compared to what was left from the Safavid period. Among the kings of Qajar, Nasiruddin Shah had an artistic vision. Of course, in cooking and food, a special style of his period has remained. One of the royal ceremonies was Ashpazan. This ceremony was held in full detail every year. Its central core was cooking, which originated from Nasiruddin Shah's personal interests in it. The cooking of Nazri Ash was founded for the health of the king by his mother, Malik Jahan Khanum, and according to another story, Amina Akhdas, his wife. Dr. Jean-Baptiste Favreau also believes that this type of Ash was vowed by the king in the year of the outbreak of cholera to protect himself from the disease. This ceremony was held in the early autumn when all the men, nobles, and lords gathered in Surkh-e-Hisar. The sofre was spread under the tents, and the nobles of the country used to sit on the ground and clean vegetables and peel eggplants. They used all kinds of vegetables and summer fruits, dried and fresh fruits, nuts, melons, sugar, turmeric, saffron, rice, wheat, lamb, and poultry in this ash. There were 30 huge cauldrons on fire pits. When ash was prepared, women would come out and Anisadol poured the first bowl of ash for Nasiruddin Shah with a golden ladle, and then others would start eating. This custom was maintained until the end of Nasiruddin Shah's reign, and then it was abolished. Iranians have the same skill in cooking various types of bread as they have a unique skill in cooking different types of ash. Bread and ash are predominant in Iranian cooking and play important roles in our cuisine. Cooking each of these important elements in Iranian sofre needs different skills. Many hidden treasures of the Iranian culture and history can be found in Khorasan.
روستای ترق در نزدیکی کاشمر کاشمر رو در قدیم
ترق village is located near Kashmir and has a rich history. In my opinion, if someone wants to know Iran, he must know Khorasan. The Farsi language we speak today is the same that has spread throughout Iran from this region. The Farsi language we speak today is the same, and it has spread throughout Iran from this region. I think that Khorasan still retains many of its historical features. When we look for Iranian roots, we can find many of them in Khorasan even today. Terk village is located near Kashmir and still sticks to its old texture and is full of life. There are kind and generous people in this region. They are very hospitable, and we have been staying here for a while. We got familiar with the people, their customs and traditions. We found traces of these traditions in the rich history of our land. There are different kinds of bread made of the famous Khorasan wheat, daim, which is known as red wheat. Good quality bread is prepared from this type of wheat. There are also different types of ash. According to many researchers, ash reshte basically comes from Khorasan. They cook a special kind of ash reshte in this village. In this dish, instead of using the usual vegetables that we use in other cities of our country, they use a special vegetable called kuria. They harvest this kind of vegetable from the hills around this same village. When this vegetable is dried, it is called black grass or black leaf. This vegetable is very tasty and wonderful and gives a special taste to this type of ash reshte.
خیلی سبزی خوش طعم فوق العاده ای و طعم ویژه‌ای به آش رشته مخصوص روستای ترق میده.
Chorba is cooked and eaten in neighboring countries. As its name suggests, it has Iranian roots. Ba means ash in Farsi, and there are different types of that like sirkeba or sekba or chorba that are recorded in history. This is an old Iranian tradition based on which family members gathered around a sofre which was full of love. They would eat bread and ash and were thankful for Allah's blessings. They believed that the presence of guests around such sofre would increase their blessings. The Iranian sofre has been formed in full compliance with the special climate of this land. Water wasn't available and cultivation was impossible before. They had to take water from far away to the agricultural lands or to the homes. Therefore, the collective intelligence of Iranians has formed a special school of cooking based on the mentioned conditions. This type of cooking has an amazing and unique variety despite the many natural limitations. Iranians also paid attention to other matters such as architecture and urban engineering. They considered the details and adaptability of these buildings according to nature and the climate. Jami Mosque of Gonabad is an example of artistry, elegance, and harmony with nature and climate. This mosque has two porches, which is known as the Khorasani-style mosque. Various types of Khorasani ash are unique, just like Khorasani architecture. Among these different kinds of ash, Ashjush Pare has a distinct appearance and also tastes wonderful. Ashjush Pare had different appearances according to recipes written in Safavid cookbook. They put ingredients of Ashjush Pare in dumpling wrappers and then cook them. Then they add kashk, roasted poppy, and mint fried in oil. When a person eats Ashjush Pare, he experiences delicious flavors. They use a combination of beans, lentils, spices, and vegetables in this type of ash. This extremely delicious dish does not contain meat. Eshkene is the most important type of Iranian food apart from ash. The history of this dish goes back to the ancient past. It is a simple and accessible food that can be prepared from very simple ingredients. One could satiate his hunger by eating eshkene. It also optimizes people's energy. Iranians used this food a lot until a few decades ago, but today they rarely eat eshkene. The people of every corner of Iran prepared eshkene using available ingredients in their regions. One can prepare eshkene with a handful of flour and available fragrant vegetables and add pieces of bread. Using bread makes it a filling dish. Farmers and workers used to eat eshkene. Today we could say that ash and aplusht derived from eshkene. They use chunky pieces of bread in tilit, ash, abgusht, and eshkene. A kind of taftan that is baked in some regions of Khorasan is completely different from the kinds of bread baked in Tehran and Isfahan. The size and thickness of this bread makes it filling for people who use it. There's a kind of eshkene that is made of yogurt. This dish is really famous in Khorasan. They serve it with roasted tomatoes and eggplants. The full plate of this meal eshkene comes with pieces of bread in it, roasted tomatoes, eggplants. This dish is healthy, simple, very delicious, and is made without meat. They make ash with flour or dough balls, wheat, barley, and rice. Noodles are sometimes main ingredients of some types of ash. Cutting noodles in Sultaniye and Zanjan has a long history.
برخلاف ادعای بسیاری رشته قطعا از اروپا به ایران نیامده بلکه
contrary to many claims, noodles definitely did not come to Iran from Europe. It was the other way around, and noodles went from the east to the west. In our ancient texts, we can see names of different types of noodles that people used, like bandeqaba, gisuye yar, pulati, among many others. It shows that we have a long history in using noodles. It is probably the case that we learned how to eat noodles from our eastern neighbors. Maybe we learned it from the Chinese.
شاید از چین در واقع به ایران آمده باشه. در اینجایی که ما هستیم گزلدره
یک Now we are in Gozaldare, Sofla. We will visit a place where they cut noodles. We will know about the process of making noodles.
خواهیم دید
Cutting noodles is a very common job in Sultania and Gozaldare, Sofla. It means that there are several workshops and people eat different types of noodles. Sultania was a center of the Ilkhanids government, and it may be the reason why so many people eat noodles in this area. Eating Chinese food was the Ilkhanids culture and can be the reason for the establishment of so many workshops here. These workshops are still active. Sultania was a city that did not last many years. It suddenly appeared in history by the Ilkhanid kings, and it was destroyed after Muhammad Khodabandi's death. He left many important works in this area, like knife making in Zanjan, cutting noodles, and Dashkasan temple.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray five times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayru din Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about three types of blood discharge. Well, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography and then we'll be back. Don't go away.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and our guest speaker, Sheikh Javid. Let me greet him. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Javid, and thank you for coming to the studio.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, as promised, let's talk about different types of blood discharge, all right, that women are experiencing. Let me ask you by this question, in fact, or begin our episode with this question. What is the difference between, for example, haiz or istihada blood?
Well, there are some signs or symptoms which must be taken into consideration when describing the haiz blood or istihaza. Of course, I should use the term haiz, and the term haiz is the monthly cycle or the monthly period, which is sometimes translated as, you know, menstrual blood, and the istihaza blood is the irregular blood that a woman discharges at any time, at any moment, regardless of what age she is, okay? Because if a woman, let's say, discharges blood for a few hours and then she no longer discharges any blood, then it's not considered to be the monthly period. It's not considered to be menstrual blood. So the period of haiz or menses is not less than 3 days and not more than 10 days. So the first 3 days of menstruation should be continuous. And when it comes to the signs of the blood, the difference between these two types of blood, of course, the blood of haiz or the blood of menses is thick, it is red sometimes, it is red and it's sometimes very dark, and it comes with, it is discharged with irritation, and it usually appears at a fixed time. You know, the ladies have a habit of, you know, they have a fixed habit, and they know when it is discharged and when it's not discharged. When it comes to the irregular blood, which is called istihaza, of course, istihaza, the istihaza blood may appear at any time, and it's not continuous. It comes on and off. So the rules regarding istihaza and the haiz are very much different.
Mm-hmm, I see.
Because when a lady is in her menses, and when she gets her period, she has to abide by certain rules and certain regulations. For example, she cannot enter a mosque. She cannot pray, nor can she fast.
Mm-hmm.
And she cannot, for example, touch the scripts of the Holy Quran.
Mm-hmm.
She cannot also recite them, you know, those chapters of the Holy Quran which include the sajda, of course. Again, I should say that according to His Eminence, that chapters which include the sajda should not be recited. But according to some scholars, only those four verses which include the sajda or the obligatory sajda should not be recited.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we will discuss it further as we continue progress.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. Let's take a short break and we'll be back with more questions in this program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad Hoots, in this program, and our guest speaker, Sheikh Javed. We are still talking about the different kinds of blood discharge experienced by the ladies and women. Well, Sheikh Javed, what's the rule or Islamic law on the reddish or brownish discharge that appears after the menstrual blood discharge? Is it considered part of the menses or menstruation?
Again, this question is very much applicable, and of course, a lot of ladies wonder as to what they should do with the brownish discharge after they have their regular monthly period.
Mm-hmm.
So I should say that based on the fatwa of His Eminence, if this brownish or reddish discharge or pinkish discharge comes within the 10 days from the beginning of the period until the last days, and if this blood comes or flows or comes out or appears within the 10 days, then...
It's the maximum period,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, maximum.
What is the minimum?
The minimum, the minimum is 3 days, of
three,
course. The
not
minimum,
two.
Yeah, the minimum is 3 days. It should not be less than 3 days, even by an hour or two. You know? If it is, then, of course, the lady, the woman should repeat her prayers.
Mm-hmm.
She should, you know.
Should not consider this as menstruation.
Yeah, she should not consider this as menstruation. Rather, it should be treated as istihaza.
Mm-hmm.
So... The period of haiz or menses is not less than 3 days. It's not more than 3 days. Mm-hmm. 3 days. If the brownish discharge appears within let's say, 10 days, then it should be treated as the continuation of the monthly period. It should be considered as haiz.
Mm-hmm.
And then the woman, of course, she has to comply with the rules of haiz, and she should not forget that she is still menstruating.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So that's the main point I just wanted to make. But no, if let's see if the same pinkish or yellowish discharge appears before the actual monthly period, this is not considered to be part of hais.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just yellowish, it's not considered to be blood.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not it means that the monthly period has not yet started. It's going to start very in a few let's say hours, or maybe tomorrow or the next day. These are symptoms, but it's not treated. It's the blood which comes before the actual time of the monthly period. If it is pinkish or yellowish, this is not treated as blood if it comes before the actual time of the period.
Mm-hmm, I see. Shishovit, you said that there are certain rules applicable to women in their menses, right? For example, they cannot touch or read the Holy Quran, especially those verses of the Holy Quran, for example, that contain sajda. But what about the women in their istihaza? Is this rule applicable to them too?
A woman in her istihaza can do a lot of things that a woman in her menses cannot do.
Mm-hmm.
She can read the Holy Quran. She can...
Even the verses containing sajda.
Of course, she can, because she can pray, she can fast.
Mm-hmm.
But depending on the quantity of blood, okay? Depending on the quantity of the blood. If the blood is little, it is called istihaza qalila,
mm-hmm.
which means that the woman should make one wudu for each prayer,
mm-hmm.
for each prayer. And it does not make any difference whether you offer a wajib prayer, like the daily obligatory prayers, or you offer qada prayers. In each case, the woman should, of course, make one wudu for each prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course...
If they are still discharging the blood while saying the prayer, is their prayer acceptable?
Yeah, except because that's okay. She's supposed to be discharging. If she is discharging, then she just make one wudu. But I just as I said, depending on the quantity of the blood, if the blood is excessive, then there are three ghusl that she must perform.
What about the prayer? Should she repeat the prayer?
No, after she performs the ghusl, then she can quickly and immediately, of course...
Say the prayer.
Perform the prayers.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Tawbi.
Sure.
And thank you very much for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio, for those who seek the truth.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله
answering a dance on questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to the listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atad, the host of this program. Sheikh Karimi is the guest speaker for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the world of Barzakh. There are so many doubts and questions regarding the interval between this world and the hereafter called as Barzakh. What is this world exactly? What is this place exactly? And do we have any Quranic reference or in the Rivayat and Ahadith giving us some details about this type of world?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In Arabic language, the word Barzakh means barrier between two things. And technically, it is referring to the world between this world and the hereafter. From the time that a person passes away, he or she enters the world of Barzakh till the day of judgment that all the people are resurrected. The word Barzakh has been mentioned in the Quran in three occasions, but only one of them is referring to this technical term. In other occasions, they are referring to the literal meaning of the word of Barzakh. Now, so we have one verse in the Noble Book of Quran referring directly to this world. In chapter Mu'minun, verse 99, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم حتى إذا جاء أحدهم الموت قال رب ارجعون. When death comes to one of them, he says, my Lord, take me back. لعلي أعمل صالحا فيما تركت, that I may act righteously in what I have left behind. كَلَّا إِنَّهَا كَلِمَةٌ هُوَ قَائِلُهَا. By no means, these are mere words that he says. وَمِنْ وَرَائِهِمْ بَرْزَخٌ إِلَىٰ يَوْمِ يُبْعَثُونَ. And before them is a barrier, or the world of Barzakh, until the day that they will be resurrected. So very explicitly, this verse is talking about the fact that there is an intermediary world between this world that we are living in and the world of Barzakh, and that is what we call it, the world of Barzakh. Some people translate it into purgatory, which is not a good translation, because the Christian understanding of purgatory is very much different.
It's a kind of middle world, we can say. Can we say?
Yeah, but it's not purgatory. Their understanding of purgatory is different.
That's right.
Yeah. So this is one verse in the Noble Book of Quran. When it comes to the narrations, we have many narrations about this world. Sometimes it is called the world of Barzakh, or the world of Qabr or grave, and so on and so forth. For example, in one narration, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, "Wallahi atakhawwafu alaykum fil Barzakh," addressing his Shia, says that, I'm very much afraid about you. I'm very much concerned about you regarding the world of Barzakh. Or in another narration, the Imam was asked about the world of Barzakh. He said, "Al-qabr mundu hina mawtihi ila yawm al-qiyama." Barzakh is referring to your grave. I mean, the world of the grave, from the time that you pass away till the day of judgment. And there are some other names for this world. For example, it is called Al-Qiyamatu Sughra, the lesser day of judgment, or the minor day of judgment, or the minor resurrection. And that is because of the fact that, according to some narrations, at least some people are rewarded in the world of Barzakh, and some people are punished based on their actions. And also it is called the world of Mithal. And I mean, the reason that it is called Mithal is, this technical term is in answer to the question that, are we going to live in the world of Barzakh, in a physical form or in a spiritual form? Mm-hmm. The understanding of the famous answer of the Shia scholars to this question is that something in between, and they call it a mithali body. A mithali body is referring to, a body which looks like the physical one, but it's not physical. Somehow we can compare it to what we see in our dreams, but with slight differences. So the point is that when we pass away, our soul, according to, famous understanding, our soul has a body which is not physical, but it looks like the physical body of us in this world.
Okay.
Now, there are some points about the world of Barzakh, for example, when the people are put in the grave or they, pass away. One of the main points of the world of Barzakh in the first stage is what we call it su'al, or the question in the grave. And according to many narrations, both in Shia and Sunni sources, all the people, without exception, are asked about their beliefs and their deeds in this world, in the world of Barzakh, when they are put in the grave. The next point is about reward and punishment in the grave. Now, some verses of the Quran, according to some scholars, they refer to the fact that right from the time that you are put in the grave, you may be rewarded by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, or you may be punished. It has been mentioned in the Noble Book of Quran regarding some believers that peace be upon you. The angels, when they take the soul of some of the believers, they say that they give them glad tidings, that peace be upon you, and now you are going to enter the heaven. We know that it's not the eternal heaven, so according to some scholars, it is referring to that smaller heaven in the grave. And for Pharaoh, for example, we have a verse referring to the fact that right from the time that he passes away, he is punished by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this is not the day of judgment. So they said that it is referring to his punishment in the world of Barzakh, or in his grave.
IRIB English Radio presents Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Praises to Allah, all glory is to Allah, we
worship Allah and no one but Allah. But can we say that the world of Barzakh is an outer world where the soul enters? Or no, it is the Barzakh of your soul. You are in fact going down to your soul, because when you pass away, the soul is separated from your body. So now, is this soul entering a new world? Or no, we can say you are entering your soul. The world of your internal, the Barzakh of your amal is with yourself. Now you can enter it. Or no, you are entering a separate world.
The point is that, as I mentioned, we are talking about the mithali world.
Mm-hmm.
It is different from this world, but it is not the world of the hereafter. Okay, of course, we are not talking about physical world. Spiritually speaking, it is a separate world from this world. But does it mean that necessarily speaking, physically speaking, it is outside this world? Not necessarily. So the soul joins a mithali body, which looks like the physical body, but it doesn't have any physical feature.
Okay.
And then they continue to be in this world until the day that all the people are resurrected by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, there are some discussions about the world of Barzakh. Are all people punished or rewarded by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the grave? According to some scholars, it's not for all the people. The reward is for some people. The punishment is for some people. And some people just pass the world of Barzakh as if they are asleep. And but the other viewpoint is that no, the punishment and reward is for all the people. The next point is that sometimes some good people are punished in the world of Barzakh for some of the sins of these people to be forgiven by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.